bill I would like to take up, the Senate Bill 113, the Public Officers Compensation Commission. At the last meeting, we dealt with several amendments to the bill, discussed them publicly. There were also several technical amendments that the court system proposed at that time. The CS that you have in your folder now incorporates all of the substantive amendments and the technical amendments that we're talking about. I was going to walk the bill around. I felt it would be easier for every member to peruse it quickly and benefit the committee's wish to adopt the committee substitute and move the bill out of committee. Senator Porcheau, I believe my staff provided you with all that information.
I didn't see it. It looked nice.
Yes, sir. And Senator Duncan, I, as you said previously, you were contacted also. Are there any other questions or thoughts or changes that any other member of the committee wishes to propose at this time? Okay. May I have a motion with regard to the committee substitute? Senator Porcheau?
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt the state fair CS and milk payment limit of the original bill, Senate Bill 113.
You've heard the motion. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection to the motion, the committee substitute is adopted. Senator Porcheau?
Mr. Chairman, I would move and ask unanimous consent that we report out the new CS with individual recommendations.
You've heard the motion. Is there any objection to moving the bill from committee? Hearing no objection, the bill is passed from committee with individual recommendations. Next, I would like to bring up Senate Bill 104, Condemnation Practices. It's the chairman's bill. Just before, it is somewhat complex. The essence of the bill is to allow for certain compensation for businesses. Do we have members of the public or the administration that are here to testify today? Report, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Otteson. I'm with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, the Director of Engineering and Operations Standards. This is a bill that contains elements that we can support, but on the whole, we cannot endorse it in its current form. First, we agree that making relocation benefits applicable to all projects, regardless of whether federal funding is involved, is a good idea. We previously supported this idea, and we think the change is only fair. Second, we would agree that in some circumstances, there can be business losses resulting from an eminent domain proceeding, which are not adequately compensated under the strict application of the eminent domain clause in the Constitution and the appropriate statutes, including relocation. A targeted solution which extends compensation for certain types of unavoidable and verifiable business losses is fair, provided it neither creates windfalls nor burdens project advancement unnecessarily. Our objections to the bill are detailed and quite lengthy, as I'm sure you know. I hope you've seen the position paper. I will not try to give you the blow-by-blow detail of that paper, but rather summarize some key points. One is there will be significant time impacts to current and future projects, with the possible loss of federal funds if projects can't proceed while business loss disputes are adjudicated. The greatest impacts would be in this and the next federal fiscal year, though in general, project timetables, which involve business takings, will be extended by about 1 year. We have estimated that loss on current projects could be 10 to 20 million, just simply because projects that are going through the pipeline would suddenly have a new step to have to jump through. And if we can't use that money by September 30 of this year, if we can't say that we own all the right-of-way, we can't use that money.
You have a question, Senator Duncan?
Just on that point, unless
yes,
you don't want an interruption, but just on that point, let me be sure I understand.
Can you turn your microphone off? I'll try to comment on this issue.
Yeah. You're saying because of the immediate effective date of this may slow down some condemnation, therefore you can't use money that's federal dollars been committed to a project. That project may slow down enough that you lose the federal dollars. Is that what you're saying?
Senator Duncan, through the chair, we have, every year we have a pot of money which we have to use up. Mm-hmm. On projects, be it this project or that project, which means that we have our job to do is to get enough projects ready in the right sizes that fit within that large lump of federal money. And every year it's been a push. In the past couple of years, we've had two things sort of working at us. One, jobs are getting more complex. Right-of-way is getting more complex to actually acquire because we're involving more and more urban development. The environmental rules make it tougher. So projects have been slowing down. And at the same time, Just this year, we received almost $20 million additional money that we have to obligate that we didn't anticipate at the start of the federal fiscal year. So we had to find projects, usher them along quickly enough to come along, and right away is the very last step of any project. It's the things you're doing right up to the last minute, you know, September 15th, September 20th, trying to get them obligated for the end of that federal fiscal year.
Yeah, I was just going to, Mr. Chairman, make the point that it seems to me, and I know this happens sometimes, projects that DOT has planned sometimes run into problems, so you don't get it done, but there's always projects on the shelf, seems to me, where you can use that federal dollars. Doesn't mean you're going to lose the federal dollars. It means you may have to shift it to a different project and delay Project A for a while. In fact, I've known that to happen. I was just going to suggest it. I know several projects that are kind of waiting in line, and if this bill, as we pass it, should cause certain projects to be slowed down, I'd be very anxious to help you find another project that's ready to go that you can shift those federal dollars to.
If I can lose them, but still use them. We do try to do that, if I can just explain. What happens and what's been happening is our backlog of shelf jobs has gone down. We simply are running out of shelf jobs. Even last year, we accelerated a number of projects like bridge projects, which are very clean. They have few environmental problems. They have few right-of-way problems. They absorb a fair amount of money. The other problem you get is that at the end, you get this balancing job. If you suddenly have a hiccup in a $20 million job, that means you have to have some combination of smaller projects that fit within $20 million. Vice versa, if you have a hiccup in a $5 million job, and what's sitting on the shelf is $20 million, it doesn't fit. You can't substitute a $20 million job for a $5 million job. So it's a great deal of juggling, having a variety of jobs, a variety of sizes, and not having something like a wetlands permit or a toxic and hazardous waste site jump into your project or a business loss dispute, which takes you to court. It causes you to lose momentum. This is a 1 or 2 year problem if the bill has an immediate effective date, and that's really the gist of it.
Could you continue with some of the concerns the department has?
The next thing that applies is that there will be numerous costs will be added to our projects in assessing business losses, going to court, and hiring experts. These costs and the cost of compensating for business losses directly are not eligible for federal funds. Thus, new general fund appropriations will be needed on an annual basis. We have conservatively estimated this to be $2 million per year. And I think if I took counsel from a number of people within the department and with the Attorney General's office about what the number might be, that's probably a low-ball estimate. It could easily be higher. Just to give you one anecdote, we had a single business loss claim this year, which was denied in the courts, which was for $2 million on a single piece of property. A third point is that these amendments go to the very heart of our current procedures and seem intended to make it slower, more costly, and more cumbersome. This bestows tremendous leverage to the property and business owners to seek settlements in excess of real damages. If we're faced with settling for an extra $100,000, which we don't believe is due, in lieu of losing $10 or $20 million in federal funds, you can see how much leverage this gives to the property owner. These amendments stifle the declaration of taking procedure by adding new time requirements, limiting the use of the master's hearing process in favor of trial, and adding procedural steps which are not practical, such as requiring that we subdivide someone's property before we own it or have even begun negotiations. Another area of concern is placing the burden of proof on the state to determine these costs. We must identify these business damages prior to negotiations, and we have no legal right to their business records to estimate them. The two states that do have a business loss provision that we're now aware of, Florida and California, both have clearly placed the burden of proof on the business owner and have required that they come forward with their business records to demonstrate that. Finally, the payment of these damages is made a part of the eminent domain proceeding. Again, in Florida and California, the compensation process for business damages is kept separate as an administrative process and is not intertwined with the eminent domain proceeding. And this helps to avoid the delays and the costly procedures that I've already described. Our own belief is that an expansion of relocation benefits could be structured to address business losses, which aren't now compensable. This would result in a process which doesn't disrupt current administrative procedures, would compensate for legitimate losses not now covered, and would strike a reasonable balance between protecting private rights and fulfilling the public interest. Any solution should have four main points. There should be clear working definitions of what losses are compensable. There should be a non-duplication of payment provision so that you don't end up paying somebody for a business loss and also paying for that damage as part of relocation benefits or as part of the eminent domain payment. The burden of proof for business losses should rest with the business, and the maximum compensation in total should never exceed simply the fair market value of that business if it were to be sold in the marketplace. And with that, I'll conclude As I said, our fiscal note is $2 million into the capital budget. We're not estimating any new staff, but there would certainly be a lot of consultants that would be hired in the form of accountants and various kinds of appraisal specialists.
Before I ask for questions from the committee, you've spoke rather positively about the state of California procedure and some of the negative points that you've made. The state of California procedure takes care of five and two of your concerns. That's, you know, burden of proof and the payment is administrative there. The procedure under the California system, since it is administrative, I presume would be more agreeable to you than a more lengthy procedure.
It would, Mr. Chairman, it would appear to be a reasonable solution. It sets forth a number of key points that I've addressed, the points of burden of proof and a fairly tight definition of what is a compensable business loss. In talking to those staff people down in California, they still tell me that the courts are trying to interpret that, and they've come up with some pretty interesting stretching of the original definition.
Our own courts have struggled with this area as well. It's not an easy one. Are there any questions from members of the committee? If there are not, I'd like to ask Mr. Dick Winey, who's an attorney from Anchorage, who's on teleconference, to testify on this bill before. He's essentially the expert on the other side. You can stay right there if you'd like to. Mr. Winey, are you on the line, sir?
I am on teleconference, if you can hear me.
Loud and clear, sir. Did you hear the preceding testimony that Mr. Austin made?
Yes, I heard most of it, and I'm prepared to respond to it.
If you could at this time, sir.
First, I'm very pleased to hear the state concedes that relocation benefits and all the benefits imposed by the Uniform Acquisition Act of Title 34, Section 60 are appropriate regardless of funding source. It's fair, and we're in agreement upon that issue. Now, I'll address the other points Mr. Austin made in somewhat the order in which they were made. Well, again, I am pleased to hear that the state agrees that business loss should be compensable, at least in some circumstances. I have heard his commentary with regard to the timing impact upon pending federal projects, indicating, I think, that maybe $10 or $20 million would be in jeopardy, and they have, as I heard, an October 30, 1991 deadline for certifying right-of-way. If my understanding of that is correct, and my hearing over the teleconference is incorrect, I'd request that be corrected. Frankly, a lot of it deals with the effective date of the bill. I think, for instance, that if we are dealing with a deadline during the current construction season of October 30th, imposing effective date of the bill in terms of when it goes into effect, such as November 1st or something appropriate after that deadline, would solve that problem. Now, Mr. Austin addressed the effect of the bill on ability of the state to certify right-of-way acquisition for federally funded projects. This is a legitimate concern, but I don't think the bill has any effect upon that one way or the other if you have an appropriate effective date. It is my understanding that in order to secure federal funding, the state must certify to whatever federal agency is providing the funding that it has acquired the necessary right-of-way as of X date, whatever that deadline happens to be. Now, under the present bill, the declaration of taking remains intact and vile. The declaration of taking, if you remember from my testimony before this committee 2 weeks ago, is a statutory proceeding in which the state places money in court and says this is estimated just compensation for the taking. And in that declaration says the right-of-way or the property or whatever is taken is hereby vested in the state. At that point, as a matter of law, the right-of-way is vested in the state. The conditions that are imposed in Senate Bill 104 with regard to court ability to address whether, for instance, there has been an appraisal in good faith for business loans is something that should pose no problem in the future, as long as the state plans for it. If you give an effective date to the bill, say after October 30th. Now, with regard to the court determination of authority and necessity for the taking, that sort of thing, that has always been there. There's no change in any sort of procedure in that effect. With regard to the date of right of entry upon the property, in which the bill indicates shall not be less than 90 days after a court has determined the state has right to take the property to start with, that should not be a problem if there is an effective date upon the effective date of the bill. Now, with regard to costs imposed by hiring experts, that's basically a cost of doing business. They have to, under the present situation, pay the property under Title 34, Section 60, and the follows, for real property at the present time. And it's simply an extension of that type of concept. Now, maybe it would cost $2 million either, I don't know. But the essence is fairness. Is it fair that a property owner, first, to pay a greater proportionate share for a public project than anyone else? Does the public get a free ride by taking someone's business? I suggest that is grossly unfair. Now, the allegation has been made by Mr. Austin that the bill would slow things down, that it would give the property owner greater leverage. Undoubtedly, it would. Under the present scenario, the property owner has no leverage whatsoever once the declaration and taking has been filed. The process currently in effect in the courts, which I think to a large degree ignores the requirements that were imposed upon both the state and the municipalities and any other kind of law by the 1976 amendments to the Declaration of Taking Act, has left things in basically a rubber stamping type of process in actual practice before the courts. The determination of whether there is in fact a good faith business appraisal, which has been performed prior to initiation of condemnation proceedings, is a legitimate consideration. Same sense that performance of a good faith appraisal for the real property is good sense and good fairness. Because of the deference given by the courts to the condemnor's discretion in filing a declaration of taking, the ability of the courts to determine whether there has been any good faith attempt to determine just compensation, either for real property or for business loss, has largely been negated. I'm referring to the Beazy case, Alaska Supreme Court decision out of Nome in the last year, where a court may not, or at least there's substantial doubt as to whether a court may even look at the matter of just compensation that has been deposited in court at the same time that the property owner's title has been ripped away from him, divested through the declaration of taking. I ask you, gentlemen, is it fair that the municipality, any other condemnor, may file simply whimsy type of statement, this property is worth X and it is now Y? Should not a court have the opportunity to determine whether this is arbitrary and capricious or whether it's based upon a good faith appraisal? Going further to Mr. Austin's arguments, with regard to a master's hearing, the elimination of a master's hearing if all parties do not agree to the timing of certifying right-of-way. This is a straight red herring. It has no relevance whatsoever. If a declaration of taking has been used, and that is almost universally the case in state projects, and 98% the case in municipal projects, title vests in the condemnor at the time the declaration is plugged into court. a master's hearing, or a trial, follows months or years after that, and has absolutely no effect upon certification of right-of-way, acquisition of right-of-way, or anything else in the declaration of taking has been used. With regard to burden of proof upon the property owner for business loss, I thought that I had covered that in my amendments and work draft that was being filed with regard to, well, again, I guess it was eliminated from legislative drafting in June, but it would have gone to Section 3 of the bill, period 5-5, period 3-3, concerning business laws. Now, like, it's still in the bill. Check this out. It's an amendment. It says the amount of business loss before investment compensation is the amount of actual projected loss that is proved by a party of interest by a preponderance of the evidence of a master's hearing or a trial. A party of interest is the condominee. If one wanted to substitute, for instance, the word condominee in place of party of interest, that could be done. But party of interest is the language used for the rest of Title IX in describing the condominee. So that's already provided. Now, indicates that the bill would impose a new burden upon the condominee, subdivide the property prior to initiation of condemnation proceedings. Since 1975. It already exists. Should 809 period 55 period 275. My comments will now be directed toward the California statute, which has been addressed to the committee's attention. I am familiar with the California statute, but I think it's all better than nothing. There's only a fig leaf type of protection for property owners. It is grossly inadequate. It's grossly inadequate for a couple of reasons. First reason is that it is not tied to the condemnation proceeding at all. It is a separate proceeding. In a condemnation proceeding, we are dealing with a constitutional mandate of the Alaska Constitution that just compensation shall be provided for one whose property is taken for a public project. Our Alaska Supreme Court in the State v. Hammer has ruled that property includes business laws. This language does not use the term goodwill, which is not the same as business laws. Let's look at the difference between those concepts. The California statute defines goodwill, and that's the only thing that is compensable under the California statute, as benefits that accrue to a business as a result of its location, reputation, or dependability, skill or quality, and any other circumstances resulting in the probable retention of hold or acquisition of the patronage. Significantly, the California cases interpreting loss of goodwill place the date of valuation of goodwill as the fair market value of business intangibles as of the date the condemnation complaint is filed. Now, 2 weeks ago, I was discussing with you Prison versus State, a case in which Judge Carlson ruled that despite the fact that no business loss occurred until 6 months after the date of taking when the property owner was evicted from the premises, the date of valuation of business intangibles must be the date of taking, which is 6 months before any loss occurred. Now, practically speaking, this has this probable and factual result. Goodwill is not the same as business loss. It is not the same as lost profits. It is a concept which developed primarily in income tax law, resulting from the constitutional amendment which enacted prohibition, and it was to somehow provide the breweries that have been shut down with some manner of compensation to the act, and the standard that has been developed for that is what is known as the IRS goodwill formula. Now you do this. You first figure out what would be compensation for the owner if he ran the business. I mean, what's the owner's salary, et cetera, et cetera. You then look at the the inventory of business, what is the land, what is the equipment, that sort of thing. Then you determine what is the normal rate of return on this business. However, for instance, if you have a situation such as that which was occurring in Anchorage through the pipeline boom, you have a situation in which business is improving and in which land value is escalating out of sight. Many times the increase of the amount of business, let's say that your business is increasing 10% a year, but let's say, as in the days of the pipeline boom, you have land value that's escalating at 30 or 40%. Now, if the land value escalation exceeds the business value, there is no goodwill under the permit. There is no compensation of property owner under the permit. Goodwill is merely an IRS term for the value that a willing buyer will place upon excess earnings over normal earnings. And it is in essence meaningless. Now, what application does that have to someone who operates a business? It's a small business. And the land value, say, is escalating at 15% a year. His business is escalating at 5 to 10% a year, but it's still growing. It's a fledgling business, for instance. Under the California formula, under the goodwill formula, despite the fact that this guy is increasing in business every year and has been, say, for 5 years, and it is projected by competent economic appraisers that because of the past record and because of economic trends, this business will continue to grow. He is wiped out in terms of goodwill compensation if his land value is escalating faster. That's not fair, and that's not just compensation. With regard to one point that Mr. Austin made with regard to the need of business records, that is covered in the California statute. I think that's a legitimate point. Under the amendments to Title IV, Section 60, there is a requirement that there be appraisal for both the land and, of course, any property that's on the land prior to the filing of condemnation actions, prior to the initiation of even negotiations with the property owner. Title 3460 amendments under the current bill, which is pending, would require the same appraisal in good faith for business laws. I think it is a legitimate concern of the state that the state, in order to prepare an adequate good faith appraisal of business laws, have access to such business records of the property owner as are necessary for the appraisal of that business, even as they are entitled to, say, look at the property, go on to the property, that sort of thing, for the purpose of appraising the real property. If I'm turning to Section 1263.520 of the California statute, which deal with state tax returns, I think a similar provision would be fair prior to the initiation of negotiations with regard to acquisition of property, related to business records which are necessary to allow the state to perform a good faith appraisal business. And now the California statute talks to turning over tax records and data to a court which will then file, then make them available to the state or the condemning agency. Now that language isn't really appropriate because we're dealing with a pre-condemnation situation in which court is not involved. I would suggest language somewhat to the effect that the owner of a business who claims compensation for business law shall make available to the condemnor his tax returns and such business records as are necessary for the condemnor to make a good faith business appraisal. That the records should be used confidentially and only for the purpose. But that if the property owner wants to make business claim, business laws claim, that he's required as a condition precedent to turn those records over to the any agency so that a fair appraisal can be made. I don't have exact language before me, but I drafted to accomplish that. That can be accomplished very easily in the legislature. So I would be glad to fire proposed language down. But I think that would take care of the concern of where need business records satisfy the concern that was expressed by Mr. Austin. Again, materials raised over burden of proof as to business loss. But that is already addressed in the bill, section 3, imposing burden of proving business loss upon property owner if the issue is litigated. By conclusion, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that come up, is that if, for instance, we were to add a section to the bill, particularly a section entitled 34, chapter 60, with regard to the provision of deterrents and business records to the county more prior to negotiation so that an appraisal can be made, 90% of that concern could be taken care of. Effective date of the bill, I think probably should be 1 month in the future, maybe at the end of this construction season, and to apply prospectively to new projects. I don't think it would be fair right now, for instance, to the state or to the municipality down to have the argument raised that the legislature has enacted both for business laws this session. Therefore, we should have to be up in a condemnation action filed 2 years ago. That's not the bill. But those are my main concerns. I guess, in conclusion, come back to arguments were made before this committee by Mr. Gilder in the sort of presentation, that it is fair to provide this business loss to companies. But if we are fair, we can't afford on the concrete. No problem with that. I'll be glad to entertain your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Boyink. Obviously, there is a great deal more work to be done in this bill. What I would suggest, I know that Mr. Geldorf is anxious to respond. What I would propose we do, rather than we do have other bills before the committee, is that the chairman, since he is the sponsor of the bill, will take it as a subcommittee of one, sit down with the department, the Attorney General's office, and with you, Mr. Weinig, and work through these details. It's time-consuming. I want to have a bill that is clear to every member of this committee, and it does not have another referral beyond this one. So even if some members don't agree with it or the department doesn't agree with it, it is absolutely clear exactly what we've done and how we've done it, and we can let the members decide upon the fate. But I do want to do that. It's obvious that we could spend easily 10 hours on this, just getting down to the points of difference that we are unable to agree on. Does that sound like something that you'd be willing to participate in, Mr. Weinig?
Absolutely. Tim has my number and address. I would be willing to devote any time necessary to work out the differences. Just let me know when I will make my time available.
I'll discuss the matter with Mr. Benatenda either later today or tomorrow, and we will contact you. There are two other people to testify, Jim Morgan and Paul Humphrey. If I could, you're certainly welcome to testify. If you could keep your testimony as brief as possible, because we will be working on the bill in subcommittee and bringing it back. And if you wish to hold your testimony until you have an opportunity to see the version that we come back with, I would understand that too. What is it, Mr. Morgan? What is your pleasure, sir?
Senator Rohde, I would like to just say a few things if I could in response to Mr. Austin's testimony. As far as the costs are concerned, those costs are already there. Again, like Dick Weinig said, you know, that right now they're being paid by the citizens that are impacted by the condemnation, and that shouldn't be. They should be paid by the state, municipality, whatever the required agency is. They should pay for the full cost of the project. You know, by law, that's the way it should be, and that's not what's happening now. It shouldn't cost one individual more than the other. And as far as the excess cost in the Raspberry Road project, I can see where they've wasted $4 to $5 million in my estimation. Again, because of the $3.4 million that they assigned to the Attorney General's office to litigate $13.6 million worth of property. They separated two projects. The one that's being constructed now, the Raspberry Road project, with Fighter Oil Admittance, was going to cost $1.5 to $3 million. And I believe when this is all over, we are going to win our case. And the state is going to have to pay for short-term business loss anyway, plus a lot of attorney fees. And our master attorney, we were awarded short and long-term business loss. The amounts weren't correct, so we are scheduled for a jury trial in January of 82. The state is trying to settle this, so it might be settled before that. I don't know for sure. Right now, there's no settlement in our case. The pressure that shouldn't be put on the citizens, to put on the citizen that's impacted by condemnation. They shouldn't be sitting in 3 days of depositions during the busiest time of the year being treated like a criminal like I was. The state shouldn't be reaching stipulations with oil companies like they did with Texaco to try to put us out like the state did. The person impacted by condemnation should not be tied up for 7 years like we have been wondering what to do. I also want to let you know that there were several other people here that wanted to testify. They couldn't make it today, and that was Bob Dodd, who owns three Texaco stations, Tom Barber, Spinora Upholstery, Mike Anderson, who had a pizza place on Northern Lights Boulevard, Dick Sullivan, the Chevron station impacted by the Radnor Road project, Ron Eagley of Winnie's, and Mike Club, the Tasty Freeze. Thank you, Pat.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Mr. Morgan, you'll have additional opportunities to comment on at least the subcommittee's work and the matter to be brought back before the committee. Mr. Humphrey, did you wish to make any comments this time?
Yes, I'd like to make just one. First of all, I'm pleased to see that Senate Bill 104 is being introduced. My comments relate to the need for this. We have a business out on Diamond and New Stewart Highway in Anchorage for by the widening of the Diamond project, where a fence was put across our driveway cutting off our ingress and egress. This was done without any offering of any compensation for real property or for business costs. I would just like to comment on the unfairness of this. This bill seems to be in the right track of rectifying this. If we hadn't had funds available to fight the Department of Transportation for a number of years, we would have had to roll over and play dead like everyone else. Got absolutely nothing for having our business approved.
Thank you very much, Mr. Humphrey. I would appreciate it if you could jot me a short letter that would detail the difficulties that you've had with the department and the present law, so I can include that in the folder for the members. That would be most helpful, sir.
I'd be happy to do that, Senator Bryan.
Thank you, sir. Those are all the people I have for the teleconference. As I mentioned, the committee, I will take it as a subcommittee of one, and we will proceed with it. It will come back before the members of the committee when I judge it in sufficiently good shape and the issues very clearly formed, so the committee can make its decision on it. Thank you very much, those of you that are on teleconference. At this time, I would like to lay that bill aside and proceed to Senate Bill 192, Forfeiture and Drug and Alcohol Cases. Senator Sturgiluski is a sponsor of that bill. Senator Sturgiluski, please join us.
Are you still on teleconference?
No, madam, we're not.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for scheduling the bill. This may be an old friend. I hope it's an old friend.
It is.
It has been before the legislature in the last two legislatures, has been voted on both times by the Senate, and has made its way, unfortunately, late in the session in both of the legislatures to the House Judiciary Committee, where it did not move. And I've had an indication of interest in seeing and working with this on the House side. Basically, I have outlined and will not go into detail unless you would want me to, the memorandum that tells what a bit about the bill and the sections. We have provided a sectional analysis. We do not yet have a fiscal note, but the Senate Finance did zero out, and it was a zero fiscal note when the bill went to the floor before. I would like to state that the bill is not intended to change law enforcement practices. Currently, seizures are done in connection with the federal law enforcement and in federal courts. In other words, we are not bringing in new concepts. This will fill in if we're denied the access to the federal courts. In addition, we pay some 10 to 15% to the feds of the proceeds for allowing us to use their courts. This would allow us to use state courts to process seizures of items not currently forfeitable under state law. It does establish an administrative procedure to use in declaring seized property forfeit. Currently, as you know, we can only do in rem or during civil proceedings, and in rem, of course, means against the thing. So it does not have the flexibility that the federal courts allow. It would allow municipalities to share in the proceeds, and that, of course, is done able to be done under the current use of the federal courts. I would be happy to go through the major sections, but I don't know how much time you've had for review on the legislation. This is exactly the same as a legislation that passed the Senate, I believe, with one minor change by the reviser in Section 1, and Deputy Commissioner Horetsky is here to speak to that and specifics on the legislation. And we really thought about, because we put a lot of time in on this bill, as to whether we should proceed in upgrading our codes and bringing alcohol under the forfeiture and seizure bills. And the Department of Public Safety, and particularly Deputy Commissioner Horetsky, has been very helpful and supportive. And so we decided to give it its third magical try, and this time to see that we would get favorable action in the House Judiciary Committee, or at least work toward that end. With that, I would respond to questions.
Are there questions from members of the committee? As you recall, this bill did pass through the committee system last year and did pass the Senate and did not pass the House. And we have it before us in exactly the same condition that passed the Senate as
with the reviser said. Can you speak to that, Gail?
Yes, it is.
Would that be appropriate so we would
know
the...
You have the floor, Madam.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Gail Horetsky. I'm with the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Chairman, I spent my lunch hour going over this bill, and as far as I can see, line by line, the only change between the version that passed with an amendment on the Senate floor last year and this version is the addition of Section 1, right there on the first page. And I did speak with Ms. Boss, and she indicated that that had been added by the reviser. It right now allows sale of alcohol forfeited. And in this law, there are uniform forfeiture procedures, and for alcohol, it's slated for destruction, not sale. So that cross-reference was not needed, according to the reviser. And that's my understanding of the reason that that was put in. And with that exception, as so far as I could see, there wasn't a comma or a word or anything changed.
If you could briefly refresh the committee's recollection as to the procedure that is used in the bill for...
Why don't you come up here and then get a little more comfortable with your papers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to first off thank Senator Strzelecki for her persistence in reintroducing this bill. We are, as she is, hopeful that this may be the year that we could finally get it through. Mr. Chairman, to answer your question, under existing state law, you have to go to court to forfeit proceeds, and there has to be hearing and their notice requirements, etc. And our law was adopted in 1982, not been used extensively at all because of problems under the existing forfeiture scheme, including some internal contradictions within the statute itself. If you comply with one section, you're out of compliance with the other. We are going through the federal system now, we being the law enforcement community and, of course, the state troopers. The feds do take 15% right off the top for their administrative purposes, and that may be valid, but that's that money gone from state coffers that could be used for law enforcement purposes. To give you an idea of what we're talking about, I'm just reviewing the draft of our annual drug report to the legislature, and we hope to have this out in a matter of days to you. And for FY90, the amount of cash seized statewide was $1.25 million. Vehicles, roughly $200,000 worth. Property, $150,000 worth. That's in one fiscal year. And all of that goes through the federal system because our state law just isn't workable for us as we see it. Also, in addition to taking that rake off right off the top, the feds also have very strict guidelines on value. They won't take it if the car is below a certain value of the property, if there are other interests involved. And that makes sense for them. I mean, they do this nationwide. They have to draw the line somewhere. But for our small communities, a car that's worth $3,000-$4,000 may be very useful to them as an undercover surveillance car, or, you know, they could sell it themselves and take the money and do something else. So what's not worth their time at the federal level may well be worth our time at the local level. This bill establishes a second avenue for forfeiture. It keeps the existing forfeiture that you can do it in rem, you can do it through the criminal court proceeding once that's resolved. But if it's under $100,000 and not real property, then the property or the vehicle, the cash, can be forfeited administratively under guidelines set by the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. And this is how the feds do it. The feds do it administratively, and that's what we would be doing too. Now, if the property is over $100,000, if it's real property, or if the person contests, then it goes into the regular procedure under court. So you have to have a judge make a finding of fact, and he sits without a jury and makes a finding based on the preponderance of the evidence. The bill, if you're not familiar with it, looks pretty intimidating. There's a lot of cross-references, but really that the scheme that it sets out is much clearer and straightforward than what we have now. And we believe that the addition of an administrative forfeiture scheme or program would have considerable value in terms of streamlining these processes, getting more money to the locals for their use in this war on drugs, and also just making the whole system be a little less cumbersome, a little more speedy, a little more efficient. It's not right to have things sitting around on the lot for 2, 3, 4 years deteriorating before you get a court order that tells you you can use it. By the time you can use it, you don't have a use for it.
What starts the process then is either the conviction of a person that is related to the property, or that property is related, or an indictment from the grand jury that finds the property or the evidence of, that it would warrant a court to conclude that the property is subject to forfeiture. So it can be done in either two ways. Is that correct?
Well, I think there's probably three ways, and page 5 of the bill, Mr. Chairman, may be initiated by filing a motion to forfeit in a civil or criminal proceeding, or two, may be initiating by filing a separate in rem proceeding, and that would come up, for example, if we find a suitcase of money abandoned at the airport. We file an in rem proceeding because we don't know who owns it, you know, we don't know, we may suspect who owns it, but he says, I never saw that before, so that you have to do an in rem action, and then the third way to do it would be initiated by the Commissioner of Public Safety under the administrative sanctions. So you have four options, because the court one is either civil or criminal.
So you have, and there could be two ways if it's criminal, then a normal civil action, or a proceeding by the commissioner. And my recollection was that was the one of the chief difficulty in the House was the administrative action by the commissioner, among other things.
I don't recall, Mr. Chairman, that was the problem. I think there was some concerns about forfeiture itself and issues about zero tolerance and that sort of thing. I think people were just concerned about how far does the pendulum swing and are we coming back or what.
That was really the issue, is I think kind of along the line that Senator Fahrenkamp, does this mean somebody's going to take away somebody's automobile because they had a marijuana in their car? And so that was really it, as opposed to the process. But
what's the answer to that?
Mr. Chairman, I don't recall that marijuana was treated any differently than other controlled substances. And if the vehicle was being used to help sell the drug or to do something like that, then it would be proceeds or bought with the proceeds of or an instrument used. If all a person had was marijuana in his pocket and he wasn't using his car in any way to further the possession or sale or distribution of that, then I don't believe that this would apply.
That was one of the issues. Mm-hmm. But the background that was going on was several hundred
mm-hmm.
thousand dollar fishing boats being mm-hmm. seized mm-hmm. by the Coast Guard. There was many cars of a toke being impounded by the customs people for possession of marijuana and other things. And I think the concern was seizure is great when we all think about Mr. Big and big time dealers and. But if the same procedures are used against even small traffickers, the punishment represented by that seizure can exceed conviction and fining and sentencing under regular court proceedings as if they've never had a vehicle or an airplane or something. The more real case probably is the case of bootlegging, where many of these bootlegging crimes now are felonies in local option areas. That was one of Binkley's laws, I think, here. And so that you can have a very real situation where, because it is a village, airplane use is exactly how alcohol is imported. And so you can have a guy fly from Red Devil into Quetzalcoatl in his airplane that's worth $50,000, carrying two cases of booze, and he could be convicted of a felony.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are he would not receive a $50,000 fine if he went to court for two cases of booze in Quetzalcoatl.
But, Mr. Chairman, then he could forfeit his airplane. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, on page 2 of the bill, there are two answers. I want to go back to your question about the car and the joint, but just to answer this one right now, on page 2 of the bill, approximately line 23 and 24, and this is the alcohol section, it talks about right title or interest in real property if the offense making the property subject to forfeiture is a felony offense. So within the court's discretion, this is subject to forfeiture, it doesn't mean you have to, but within the court's discretion, if it was a felony offense, then a person's right title or interest in real property would be subject to forfeiture.
But we're not talking about real property by and large, right?
I thought you were when you talked about a house in Quetzalcoatl.
I don't think that's real property.
Oh, okay.
No, we have an understanding what real property
is. Real property means houses and yards and
farms. Does not include cars, does not include aircraft. So let's move back up to line 22 then, and I don't see that same felony offense next to the aircraft vehicle.
No, it's not. No, the felony limitation was for real property. The answer to the earlier question, I think, is on page 10.
Well, before we go by that, what are you reassuring me that you're not reassuring? Is that what you're saying?
I'm telling you that if it's a felony offense, a person's interest in real property is subject to forfeiture in the court's discretion.
I understand that. Now let's relate that to line 22, number 5.
Line 20. On the same page?
Page 5.
Page 2.
Aircraft.
A person who is convicted of a misdemeanor crime, if he used aircraft, vehicles, vessels, etc., in furtherance of the offense, mm-hmm. that would be subject to forfeiture, yeah.
Is that something you support?
Yes. That's existing law.
Hmm. Then
this is repeal and reenacting to make it consistent with the drug stuff.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying the only change is in number 6, that there is no change in 5?
Well, I can't recall offhand if 6 is a change or not. If you'd like me to find existing law on that, I can do that for you.
Section 1, 2, 3, 4, 6.
Okay, so yeah. 5 is in there then.
5 is current. 5 is current, but 6 is new.
If, Mr. Chairman, under existing law, AS 416-220 says forfeiture. If it's used in violation of the law where the results of the local option election prohibit the board from issuing, renewing, or transferring one or more licenses, aircrafts, vehicles, or vessels used to transport or facilitate the offense are subject to forfeiture.
And this whole thing relates just to the local option and liquor law violations.
Senator Portillo, question was, does the present statute relate to alcohol or other crimes as well?
Well, the present law that we're talking about right here is in Title IV, so it only talks about alcohol.
Okay.
But what this bill does is pull these things together and set up a uniform procedure for forfeiture of things used in violation of criminal laws. Right now there's a separate provision for forfeiting alcohol, and it's in Title IV. And then there's a provision in Title 17 that deals with drugs and imitation drugs.
So if you have a concern about subsection 5, that's legitimate, of course, but I'm just telling you it's in existing law.
Okay. But, Mr. Chairman, then to clarify, then, we are not necessarily talking about felonies as a class.
For subsection 5, we are not talking about felonies only. Right? I mean, you have to, of course, assume the court's discretion when it's... But there is no limitation that limits that only to felony offenses.
Well, okay, Mr. Chairman, let's take our new marijuana law, then. You know, we may have C misdemeanors charges against people for possession of marijuana. My guess is these are going to be taillight-type vehicle observation sorts of things that are, I assume that the police are not out there trying to make big arrests, but clearly there will be arrests in the process of other things, so that if somebody is caught with possession of marijuana in their vehicle, their car is subject to, at least subject to forfeiture.
Well, are you talking about under existing law or under the bill?
Either.
First. Okay. I would have to go back to existing law to answer that. So if you would just pardon me for just a second. Mr. Chairman, I wonder if I could just get Title 17 out of your bookshelf there.
Mr. Chairman, while we're waiting for that, I'm sure that, a lot of this is for real good reasons. I'm trying to make this work better. My concern is that, the age-old punishment fitting the crime. And when I hear expediting procedures and administrative procedures, I think we need to be real clear that as to what will happen under, aggressive enforcement under any new law on this. And I'm not too concerned. I tell you that the fishing incident in Homer and the impounding cars up on the Tok Highway really burned me. And I was glad to see our delegation even getting involved in some of that, because I don't, that is not a good use of resources, nor is it fair, and you get into real inequitable situations, I think.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I think that's really a very valid concern, and it should exercise care going through, but I think we need to understand that this procedure is being used. I mean, we're using this in the federal courts right now, and this really sets up the procedure within the state. I mean, what's going through the federal courts is being used by Alaskan, our Department of Public Safety.
I understand that, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I don't like some of that.
I see.
And I don't want to just be a participant in us doing the same thing that a lot of Alaskans didn't appreciate the federal government doing.
But that was the federal government doing it. It was not applied by our department.
Right, but my understanding is we will now use the same tools and the same types of judgments on a statement.
Well, not the judgments, I would hope.
We're dependent on our people using common sense, and I...
Well, they have been. I guess that's the point.
I don't want to give them any incentive not to use common sense, and I guess I'm looking for some reassurances.
Mr. Chairman, if this law is passed, it's our intention to use
common sense
in
enforcement.
Having said that.
Mr. Chairman, along those same lines, in sort of a general sort of sense of the word, I mean, it's going to allow the state to be able to do things that they can't do now, and it will be a tool to improve the situation, to be able to acquire the property that they can't do now. It's all good to talk about all the things that are involved and all the detail kind of things, but what's it really going to do, and are you going to be able to use it?
Mr. Chairman, we hope that it will be of great value to you, and we hope that we will be able to use it. How we anticipate using it is using the administrative forfeiture provisions through procedures set up by the Commissioner of Public Safety to handle we hope eventually the bulk of the cases that are now going through the federal system. So that means that there would be 1.25 million that would be available for use by law enforcement agencies in the state of Alaska, as opposed to having 15% of that go right off the top to the feds. That's one interest. The other is that there are items being seized now which the federal government declines to take for forfeiture, because in the federal government's eyes, it's not worth enough for them to fool with it. But our local people have a very different view of some of those decisions. And I've talked to Deputy Chief Dwayne Udland from the Anchorage Police Department, who made that point specifically to me. He says, well, you know, $5,000 may not be much to the feds, but we could really use it.
And how procedurally would you get it then? Would it be tried in a federal court, or would it be strictly that you'd go ahead and do it from a state standpoint?
We the Commissioner of Public Safety, if this bill passed, has to file a notice in the general jurisdiction.
Right.
Plus, if we actually know who the owner is, or if through serial numbers or tax records can find somebody, then we have to notify that person too. There's a time limit, then that person can file a claim for the property, and if he or she contests and requests that it go to court, then it's automatically transferred to court under this bill. If there is no response, yeah, somebody says, not my suitcase of money, or if the person just doesn't choose to fight it because he's worried about going to jail instead, then nothing else needs to happen. The time is allocated, and then the commissioner takes custody of that property. He has custody, but then he takes ownership of it, and it is transferred to the Department of Administration for sale or disposition, depending on what it is. If it's a plane, it can go to the Civil Air Patrol. You know, if it's a car, it can go to the troopers to use it as an undercover vehicle. If, depending on what the property is, if it's cash, et cetera, you have to keep track of the general fund.
Okay, so it is a very significant tool that can be used that you are not using now, and the extra property is going to go to government.
I'm sorry.
It's going to go to government. I mean, they're going to use it for whatever.
Yeah, so it will be sold, and the proceeds will go to government.
So let's say if they get a fishing boat, it can be used as an undercover fishing boat to bust some kind of a drug ring that might be occurring.
Well, if it was a fishing boat, we'd probably give it to Fish and Wildlife or something like that, and they just use it for
fishing. You really have your discretion on how to use the property.
Ultimately, it's up to the Commissioner of Administration, but there's room in the law for some input from the DPS Commissioner on the disposition.
If we could go back to Senator Porcello's
sure,
question,
yes,
and deal with the zero tolerance case that came up in Homer, where the fishing boat was taken, taken by the feds because one marijuana seed was found, and it was one of the crewmen. The owner had absolutely nothing to do with the drug trade. It was a fishing boat, and in the wisdom of the federal government, they took the boat.
Zero
would that be would that be possible under this law? I believe that was the essence of your question, sir.
Well, I think that the seizure itself would be possible. Again, I would hope that we would use better judgment than that, but the seizure itself would be possible. But there is a section in this bill, and it's actually one of the best sections of this bill vis-a-vis existing law, in my opinion. On page 8 of the bill, Senate Bill 192, it talks about relief from forfeiture. And it goes in great detail about a person who's filed a timely claim may obtain relief from forfeiture upon proof that the person has a right to title interest. In other words, that's my fishing boat. 2, did not knowingly participate in or facilitate that conduct. You know, the guy says that's my nephew and he's got a joint, but I didn't know it and I have a real strict anti-drug policy. And 3, did not know or have reasonable cause to believe that the person might engage in the conduct that resulted in the property. He says, I had no idea my nephew had a joint in his pocket. If the court believes that, I mean, it always will be a question of credibility, you know, but if the court believes that, then the court can, right at that point, order the fishing boat returned back to the owner.
Federal law does not have this provision in it.
I don't know what the federal law has in this area. We have sort of the same thing, not as well drafted, I believe, and this goes back to Senator Pershaw's earlier question, Mr. Chairman. In existing law under AS 1730.110, there's a list that says items subject to forfeiture, and under subsection 4, it says lists raw materials, controlled substance property, but number 4 is a conveyance including but not limited to aircraft, vehicles, or vessels, which has been used or intended for use in transportation, sale, receipt, possession, or concealment of property in violation of a felony offense under this chapter. So in order to take a conveyance, it has to be a felony under existing law. Then there are two...
Is that reaffirmed in this bill?
My follow-up question would be,
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
I have a follow-up question.
Yes, sir.
It would be, if the conveyance is used by someone other than the owner or the operator without the owner or operator's consent or knowledge, mm-hmm. then is it still subject to forfeiture? The airplane can quit luck, except this time a passenger hid two cases of whiskey in his duffel bag, and it was completely unknown to the operator of the plane. Perhaps this illustration was a retired state legislator.
This relief from forfeiture seems to be a good way to address the Homer situation. It does not address the case of the person who it is his car, it is his marijuana. He was caught with his marijuana in his car, and his car is worth $20,000, and he's subject to a $1,000 fine in court.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, on page 10 of the bill, subsection 5, line 17, where it lists items are subject to forfeiture, it lists aircraft, vessels, vehicles, conveyances, if the offense making the property subject to forfeiture is a felony. So the felony limitation for conveyances, which is in existing law, is retained in this bill. It's not retained for alcohol. And I remember now, this is all coming back in so long, I talked to Mr. Guinelli from the Department of Law about that discrepancy, and his answer to me was that they hadn't put that felony limitation for aircrafts and vessels and vehicles in the alcohol section because it wasn't in there now. In other words, we could forfeit something under existing law, but under the new law we couldn't. And he thought that that would be a step backwards and difficult to explain, so that change wasn't made. So subsection 5 for drugs and subsection 5 for alcohol are different.
These are the words I wanted to see. It just seems common sense that we would limit fairly severe penalties with fairly severe crimes. And we do have a change in our marijuana law since last time we visited this, and I suspect we're going to have possession violations now for marijuana that we weren't looking at before.
At what level?
Those would be misdemeanors under the new law. And those, as I understand it, would be exempt from forfeiture for, it's primarily cars.
And under page 10, lines 17 and 18, misdemeanors would not be included for.
Thanks for taking the time on this. I feel a little better.
Very thoroughly cross-examined, Mr. Retzky.
No, but this was the issue raised, and I don't think it's satisfactorily explained before, so I'm glad you pursued it then.
It is important.
Yeah, it is obviously an important one.
Mr. Chairman, along the same lines, Senator Pichel, though, we did talk about this relief from forfeiture, and wouldn't the burden of proof still be on the person, even like in the case of Senator Rohde brought up the situation where someone was flying the aircraft, but the burden of proof would still be on that person to prove that they did not knowingly participate or facilitate the conduct that resulted in the and so on. All this ABC on page 8, line 15, relief from forfeiture. The burden of proof still lies on that individual to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt to the law enforcement people that they didn't have anything to do with it, even though someone may have planted in the airplane or it was carried by someone else. Is that kind of what this does, or is it pretty safe to say that this is pretty safe for the individual rights of the individual that might be caught in a predicament like that?
Mr. Chairman, according to the terms of the bill, mm-hmm. the burden of proof is upon the innocent claimant to say, hey, I didn't know anything about that. Mm-hmm. I really do think that in enforcement of all of our laws, we attempt to inject a modicum of common sense. And if somebody gets on an Alaska Airlines jet and, you know, flies to someplace, and then we find out once he lands that there was a case of booze disguised as something else, we're not going to seize the jet. Because Alaska Airlines wasn't involved in the violation.
We need them.
We
that was
use
the answer to Senator Ray's Eastern Airlines company many years ago, and he didn't see it. Too bad he's gone.
I'm sure we can take this to the real high extremes.
And if, even if that language weren't there, someone that's caught with possession of a controlled substance or other illegal property would have to explain their innocence anyway, so it doesn't change the practical aspect of it.
One other question. I presume there is a zero fiscal note on this bill.
Yes, sir.
The fiscal note has not, for whatever reason, caught up with the bill, so if it meets the approval of the committee, I will write a zero fiscal note for the bill, and then the fiscal note from the department can catch up with the bill as it goes forward.
We would very much appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I know this has to go to the judiciary committee.
Yes,
they
sir.
Have a pretty heavy agenda this session. We probably ought to move along.
Okay. What is the pleasure of the committee?
I would move an action as consent that we pass it out with a zero fiscal note, Senate Bill 192. Individual recommendations.
You've heard the motion. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection to the motion, the bill is passed from committee with individual recommendations. Yeah, thank you. I had scheduled one other bill. We will be without a quorum because Senator Euling has to chair, and I also have to be there, the Corrections Subcommittee. We will take up Senator Schultz's bill at the next meeting, yes, which is Monday. The committee is adjourned.